Welcome to this Nederland Community Library recording of one of our programs.
Okay, so this is kind of going to be not your average sourdough or not your average class. I am not about all of the scientific, take its temperatures. This is sourdough baking for like real people who have lives and kids and laundry and carpools and that kind of thing. It's still sourdough. It's still, if you've looked up any information on sourdough, you'll find there's a deep, wide rabbit hole that you can take yourself down that will talk about taking things temperatures or having proofing boxes, and we don't need to do that. You can, and if you do get into that, and I did it for a little while, you'll be able to, you know, kind of track what differences things make. But if all you want is a loaf of bread for dinner tomorrow night, that's what we're doing here tonight. So you can, you know, kind of pick and choose what things work for you. We've got some books out here. There's some books over there. They're all going to tell you different things. They're not even going to be on the same page. So again, do what works for you. Don't be afraid to experiment with it. Have fun with it. What we're going to do tonight is, it's a beginner artisan sourdough bread, which is what this is. It's the first sourdough I got into, and I've done other ones, but this one just works really well, and I don't have to think about the recipe or the numbers or anything because it works. One of the things you want to think about, name your starter. People name their starter funny things like Doughboy. And some of them have regular names. Mine is Nameless, but it's always kind of fun. And maybe we'll have everybody post their fun names they came up with it for their starter on our library page. One thing to keep in mind as we start this, sourdough has been around since about 3000 BC. They weren't taking temperatures. They weren't cooking in cast iron pots. This was bread for everyday use. So when you start thinking you need to do all these things, you can dial it back and say, they've been doing this forever. We don't need to make it this difficult. All right, so moving on. So what is sourdough? Four things: flour, water, salt, and then starter. But the starter is flour and water, so really three things. That's all that's in this sourdough, nothing else. We're not putting any leavening agents or anything like that. It's all naturally leavened with the starter. Why do people like sourdough, or why is it good for you? It's easier to digest. The taste and texture is always better than any kind of white bread or other kind of bread. And it is a lower glycemic bread. So people that, like my mother-in-law is diabetic, should she have it? Not necessarily, but it's a better choice for her. What happens, there's a symbiotic relationship of the wild yeasts and the bacteria that's in the bread. So if you're familiar with doing kombucha at all, kind of a similar sort of deal there where they work together. The yeast in the bread consumes the starches and produces carbon dioxide, and that's where we get the rise in our bread and the bubbles. The lactobacteria in the sourdough breaks down what are called phytates. I think I got that right. Yes, phytates. And that's what makes it easier for digestion. Most seeds and grains and that have those, and that's one of the things that affects digestion. All right. So we're going to get into the equipment. All of this equipment I'm going to show you is going to be really, you don't need any of this stuff. Again, go back to what do we, I mean, did they have this before? No. Is it great to have? Yes. And you can get it relatively inexpensively. If I had to pick two items from the list, I would, a Dutch oven baker. This could be a cast or a enameled cast iron. It could be this. You can get around it. That's going to be one of the things we talk about is how to get around not having some of these items. The enamels isn't necessarily better than this. The advantage of the cast iron is its thermal mass and its ability to really hold heat in there. And why we use a covered baker is, so if you ever notice those little blisters on the crust, that's created by steam. So when bread's made commercially, they do it in a steam oven. They blast it with steam and that's how you get it. So with a covered baker, if we can cover it like this, the evaporation that's coming off of the bread is acting as its own steam oven, which is why it's a nice little enclosed system. So you get all those little crackly, crispy things that we love about bakery bread. So that's one thing that if I had to have, it would probably be that. The other thing that I would like to, that I love, and you can get them pretty cheaply, is just a kitchen scale. Don was asking me about making bread without measuring things out by weight. By weight's way more accurate than it is by volume, but you can do it. There's just a couple tricks we're going to talk about if you don't have a kitchen scale. Other items are, this is a Banneton. Can you guys see that?
Yes. Online? And can you repeat what you were saying with the crackling, the one thing you would not do without to get the top crackly crispy?
It's the cast iron Dutch oven.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, because that creates its own steam enclosed system. So this is a Banneton. Again, you can do without a Banneton, but it makes those nice, pretty little rings on it. It also takes a little of the moisture out of it so that so it doesn't stick to whatever you're putting it in. You wouldn't want to put it in a glass bowl unless you had a cloth or something in there. When I first got started, I would use my glass mixing bowl, and I would just take like a kitchen towel, and I would dust it with brown rice flour and put it in there. That'll work. The reason we're going to use brown rice flour for things is it's gluten-free, and the importance of that is it's not going to create those long strands that make things stick together. We want the gluten in our bread, but we don't want it on the surface of our bread where it's going to get stuck to towels or baskets or Bannetons or whatever. Usually I think it's just bamboo or willow or
kind of a wooden thing.
Yeah. Yep, yep.
Is an oval-shaped Dutch oven okay?
She asked if an oval-shaped Dutch oven is okay. It's fine. Yep. Probably what you want is about a 5-quart Dutch oven for a bowl that's about that big. So, I've got some cute little tiny little cast iron guys that I use for making like soup bowls, bread bowls. The other thing, one of the other items, this is a Danish dough whisk. What's nice about this is if you use a regular whisk, this stuff is so sticky. It gets all stuck in there. This is pretty easy to clean, and then you can just go like this around it and put your dough back in the thing. It's great for mixing up dough. And these are relatively inexpensive as well.
Where do you recommend we get these?
That kind of depends if you're an Amazon hater or not. Amazon does sell a nice starter kit for like $25. So And it will have, it has in it, well, I'll go through the rest of these and I'll show you what the kit has in it. And it's a good way to just get started, but you could get them at any, probably restaurant supply or any of those kind of places as well. So this was a Danish dough whisk. This is, it's called a lam. It's spelled like lame, but it's called a lam. And all it really is a razor blade on a stick, and it's bent at a curve. You can make your own using a chopstick and a razor blade, or a popsicle stick and a razor blade, something like that. What we use this for is slicing the top of the bread, and the reason you slice it before you bake it is as it rises and all that steam's coming out of it, if you don't, it's going to blow open, and you're going to get not a nice controlled crack. It's kind of like in concrete, how they build fault lines in concrete, so it cracks down a seam as opposed to just blowing open. Bench knife, you may have one of these anyway for cooking. This is super handy. Again, cheap, even cheaper. This is a bowl scraper. But the nice thing is it bends. So when you go through and you scrape out your dough, you're getting everything. Something to keep in mind is just that you don't want this dough going down your drain as much as you can possibly avoid it. It gets like cement. So as much as you can get out of your bowl and all of that, the better it is. And what else do we have? Just a large bowl. Parchment, just regular plain old parchment, not wax paper. You don't want to use wax paper. It'll melt and smoke and paint your bread and not good. And then just some tea towels or something. Oops, I'm going to go back one more thing. So if you didn't have any of these items, what could you use? So for a cast iron, instead of that, if all you had was a pot, a big soup pot, and a cookie sheet, I haven't done it. I know you can do it. It's not as ideal because it's not going to stay as hot. And you'll probably get some air leakage, so steam coming out of there. But it works. You can do it. The bannetons, a basket like I had for the bread over there, just a regular wicker basket, put a tea towel or something in there, dust it with rice flour. You'll get that nice texture on there. Doesn't really matter. You could also use a mixing bowl.
Do you put the stuff right in the basket, or do you put it in the bowl?
So if you buy one of these, they do come with a cotton cover. I don't use mine. It's something to wash. I don't want to wash it. I'm kind of lazy that way.
It doesn't stick to that stuff?
No, you're going to dust this with brown rice flour. In a pinch, if you didn't have brown rice flour, you could use cornstarch or some other gluten-free type thing. Yeah, and you can see there's some loose in there. And I don't clean these between times. It gets a little like cement in there, and maybe once every few months I'll take something and route it out and just start over again. It's fine. You just want to make sure they dry in between bakes, or they can mold, but that's really no problem up here. It dries fast. The bench knife, we're going to get to it later, but what we're using this for is mostly is shaping. And if you didn't have one, I've made do when I've been traveling with a like a pancake spatula, just trying to hold it on its side. Just, you want something stiff. So you can kind of, if you had a trowel, a mason's trowel or something, you could use that kind of thing too. All right. Are there any questions? Anybody online? All right, we're going to move on. All right, starting a starter. I'm going to go through this pretty quick because I'm going to give you guys starters, and you probably all have some of you may have started starters. My starter, I started years ago when I was making kombucha, I used my kombucha yeast and took that and mixed it in with some flour and water, and that's how mine got started. But wild capture is what it's called when you're going to start with flour and water and let it sit. The yeast comes from different places. It's going to come from your environment. Sourdough from San Francisco is a specific type of yeast that's native to that area. So while you can make a San Francisco type bread here, it's not a true San Francisco sourdough because
the culture's going to migrate to where you are.
It is. It's going to be, you know, like if you had strawberries growing in your yard and your windows open, well, strawberries tend to have yeast on them. That's good. Your starter's going to be slightly different than my starter. Your hand, everybody's hands has yeast on it. So you as the baker working with these products is going to create its own thing. The flours you use all have different types of yeast on them, rye flour, wheat flour, all of that is going to affect the type of starter. That's why a lot of people maintain multiple different starters and give them different names. one may be just an all rye flour starter. One may be a wheat starter. And one, maybe they started from, you know, you can start it from fruit waters to get it going. Fruit or raisin waters, that's kind of common. And in my case, kombucha yeast, because I thought, why not? I've got a whole bunch of it. Let's try it. And it worked. So if you were interested in capturing your own and trying the different things, basically you're going to mix a one-to-one ratio of flour to water. So if I'm putting a half a cup of flour, half a cup of water, or if you're going to weigh it, the great thing about water is it's got equal weight, or it's, you know, if you need 100 milliliters of water weighs 100 grams of water. So if you are using, if you're going by weight, the nice thing is you don't have to change your scale back and forth. You can just leave it on grams and let it go. So you're going to, that's called 100% hydration when you have equal parts water and flour. So if you were to make this, you're going to mix that up. You're going to let it sit around. You're going to discard part of it. And this is where this discard would be important. The discard we're going to talk about later, not so important. But then you're going to feed it that next time at a 1:1:1 ratio. So if I have 50 grams of starter, 50 grams of water, 50 grams of flour. Everything's equal weight. Mix that all up. Within a few days, you should start to see some bubbles in it. When that starts, then you're going to ramp up its feeding because it's getting active, and you're going to feed it twice a day after about a week or so. And this is so temperature dependent. So, you know, we say 5 to 7.
Can you review that again? It's electro. Yeah. You lost me. You feed it again?
You got to keep feeding it. This little starter is basically, that's why they call it a sourdough pet. You got to take care of it. It gets hungry. It's like a toddler that's growing. We just got to keep throwing food at it.
So you're feeding it with the rest of the mixture.
You've got your goop. You're going to get rid of half of your goop.
Right.
And then you're going to weigh it. Okay. And I'm going to say, for example, it's 50 grams. So I'm going to take that 50 grams and I'm going to mix 50 grams of water and then I'm going to mix 50 grams of flour in it. And so now I've got 150 grams of goop. But then you're going to, over the next few days, you're going to keep repeating that process more often.
Okay. Okay. Wow.
So once it stops smelling like flour and water, it may get a little funky smelling. It gets a little weird for a while. And then eventually it should start smelling kind of fresh and maybe possibly fruity. Again, it kind of depends on your flour. But once it's starting to double in size within 6 to 8 hours after a feeding, it's good to go. Starter that's immature or newly made, fairly newly made, that you can use. You smelling for the fruity? Seeing what it smells like.
Oh, yeah, we're talking about something. And it's doubling.
It's warm in here, so it's going to start probably moving fast.
It's roaring.
Yeah. Yeah.
So every day, for days 3 to 5, you're removing half?
Yeah.
And then feeding whatever's the, like, 1 to 1 to 1?
Yes.
Whatever the weight of what's left?
Yes.
Twice a day.
Which is why it's so much easier to just get it from a friend. The starter you'll get tonight, it's ready to roll. You don't have to play this game with it.
So what's the evolution of culture during this period, the 7 days?
Basically what's happening is with the damp flour and water mixture there, it's starting to trap yeast. And it's got its own yeast organisms in it. And they do a little arm wrestling back and forth to see who's going to take over the sourdough starter. And it's kind of just establishing the balance of that yeast and bacteria mixture.
So you're as long as it's doubling and you like the smell and the flavor of it, that's good.
You can go ahead and use it. Now, there are purists that'll say, you don't want to use a sourdough until it's 6 months old. Who wants to feed it that much flour and water?
Is it more sour or how does it improve or change?
It gets more depth of flavor. It'll become more balanced.
That's not objective.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly use mine right away. Why not?
Okay.
And it'll make bread. It's just not going to have the same taste as that bread you're going to make a year from now. You know, it may not be as flavorful. It may be a little more bland, a little softer.
Oh. So all sourdough starters start like this, but then you just have so much that you're giving yourself.
Yeah, I did what's called feeding it up, so I had enough to give you all. And it's something you can manipulate, how much starter you keep on hand. Some books are going to tell you, keep 30 grams in your fridge and that's it. All right, I'm going to tell you, I've got a different method and you're going to find what works for you. Yeah. Good question. She asked if when you start this, if you're trying to make your own sourdough starter, if you keep it in the refrigerator, keep it on a shelf or keep it out where it's like nice and warm, and that's what's going to create the yeast activity. Yeast likes warmth and it becomes more active the warmer that it is. Yeah.
So once you're ready to use it, you're not going to use all of it, right? Because you want to keep it.
Correct.
Okay.
And we'll go into more. She asked if when you're going to use it, if you use all of it or not. And we're going to go into that in just a little bit.
Okay.
Can it overheat? Like, can it sit in direct sun in a glass jar?
Also a good question. She asked if it can overheat if you, say, have it sitting in the sun in a glass jar. It can.
It can.
I have been impatient before and put mine out on my deck just to like try and rise it really quick so I could like feed it up. I didn't have much in my refrigerator and I need to feed it up to bake. So I tried to rush it and I put it on the deck and it got too hot. And all of a sudden, you know, it was like rose up really fast and then it just deflates and looks flat. And you're like, okay. And then I didn't have to start over again. You can almost always revive it somehow. There's usually just a few bugs left in there that'll start going.
Oh no, I lost it. Never mind.
That's okay. Done.
I've seen in recipes adding potato water and sour cream.
Okay, he asked about adding potato water and sour cream.
To your starter.
That's an old way of doing things that was common to use because the bacteria that's in there is a lactobacilli. So that's in milk and sour cream and that. You don't need to. I mean, to me, I don't like the idea of milk sitting. I don't know. It's just, to me, it's unpalatable, but it works, and it is a way that people have done it. You don't need to for this, but
Because there's already that.
That bacteria is already, It's in there. You don't need to add it in there.
That's what makes milk good sour.
Exactly. And that's what, we'll talk a little about this in the, you know, more about how to adjust the sour taste without adding something specific to it. So that's basically how you capture wild yeast should you want to start your own starter. It's tedious. There's a lot of waste. If you've got a starter, you don't need to do this. If you've got a starter that's on its last legs, you can use that starter. Kind of use this general process and mix some of that in there. Don, you had asked about your starter. You said you didn't weigh anything or whatever, and you weren't sure about if you had the right amount of water. This would be a good thing to do. If you took like a little tablespoonful of your starter and then just put an equal amount of water and flour, and every time you're going to do that, you're going to balance that hydration out to eventually it's going to be close to 100% hydration. It'll be right where you want to be. All right. Any questions online? Nope. All right. All right. How do we keep this guy alive? It is your pet. So, I've got a starter here that I have neglected on purpose so that you can see what's going on with it. So, let's see. Oh, there was one other thing I wanted to talk about here. Actually, we'll just do this first. So this starter, I don't know if you can see that there. Can you see that liquid on mine? Electra, can you see the liquid?
Yeah, I'm looking. Yeah, okay. You can.
Okay. So this liquid is kind of grayish in color. You can see that this starter is really dense. It's lost all of its air. This is starved starter. So if you shove it in the back of your refrigerator and you forget about it, it's going to get like this. It's going to get like this or worse. Okay? It can get black like that. Is it dead? No. You can revive this, but it's not going to smell good. So we're going to pass this around in just a minute.
Okay, smell-o-vision. I want to see this.
We'll do that in just a sec. I'm going to go back a slide here. I jumped ahead of myself. So how? Once you've got your starter, how do you feed it? Okay, so every time you're going to feed it, like I want to bake some bread tomorrow. And I was like, oh, okay, I need to feed my starter. For your recipe, if you look at your recipe, the recipe I use, for example, uses per loaf 100 grams of starter. So I know I need to have 100 grams of starter. Say I'm really low. I've only got 50 grams. I'm going to take that 50 grams and I'm going to add another 50 grams of water and 50 grams of flour, mix it all up. And then I'm going to let it rise. So it's going to rise up. What are you going to feed this starter? You are going to feed it whatever you want. Okay. Some people say it's got to be rye. Rye is a really active, ideal food for your starter. If you've got some rye flour, awesome. I mostly feed mine rye. For the longest time, all I fed it was regular all-purpose flour. Somebody asked about bleached or unbleached. A lot of the books are going to tell you it has to be unbleached. It doesn't have to be anything. It all works. So what you've got in your pantry is what you're going to feed it. We could go off a whole nother tangent, which we're going to not do, but gluten-free flours can be used to make a starter. I have not dabbled in that. I have no information for you on it other than to be able to refer you to a couple websites. But for the most part, what you're going to feed this starter is going to be some type of rye, wheat, or white flour. I would avoid feeding it bread flour at this point save your bread flour for making your bread. The water you're going to use, again, I don't take its temperature or anything like that. Again, think of it as a baby. Should be warm to the touch. You don't want to, if it's too hot, it's going to kill the yeast. Err on the side of cold, if anything. I've been known to take it straight from the refrigerator and put cold water in there. And again, you can get bogged down in what's the absolute most right thing to do. Best thing, warm water, room temperature starter, and your flour. Dechlorinated water is best. I use it right out of the tap sometimes if I forget to run it through my filter. This starter that I have still works. I haven't found a thing yet that really slows it down much.
We live on a well, so we have a little bit of hardness in it.
Yeah, when I started doing this, I mean, this is the first place I've ever lived where I've been on city water. So I've always used well water, and I've never had an issue with it. Okay. So it's fine. You know, how often you feed it, more to do with how often you want to bake. So Don had asked early on about some things will tell you to feed it and then discard some if it's been in the refrigerator for a long time. I'm not of the mindset to throw flour and stuff like that away. It's just you really, really, really don't need to. You'll get in a rhythm with planning your bake if you know. And that's kind of why I just never strayed from it too far for a different recipe. I've got it where I know how to time it now, and that's something I've included for you guys, kind of a general timeline that I use. But I there's no need if you do it this way to throw any away. Just plan your bakes, knowing how much you need, how much you're going to use, and you always want to save some over, because if you used everything you had, you've got nothing left. Even if you save just a tablespoon, you can do that process and feed it up. A tablespoon of starter, a tablespoon of water, a tablespoon of flour. Yeah?
Why wouldn't you just put more starter in? Why do you have only a little bit of starter? Why wouldn't you just everything which is left? Or is that what you do?
So he asked, why would you just have a little bit of starter? I wouldn't. I don't. I keep about 300 grams for me on hand. So when I do a bake, I'm going to do twice this recipe because I've got two covered bakers. I can put them both in the oven at the same time. This recipe, as it was originally written, is doubled, so you're making two loaves of bread. I have one for me. I give one to my neighbor. It works well. Sometimes we eat it all if I have people around, or we make paninis, or it makes great toast. So
let me ask the question differently.
If
I have a set series of 100 grams of right back to starter,
yes,
why wouldn't I just put 200
in your, are you talking about,
I'm making bread now.
You're talking about why wouldn't you put more starter in your recipe?
It's all the same stuff, isn't it?
No. So he asked why I wouldn't just use more starter in my dough. This is also something that we're going to get to, but the short answer to that right now is if you think about putting more starter in your dough, that's going to rush the process because it's going to be more active, which is going to change the flavor of your bread. Less starter is going to slow the process, and it's going to change the bread flavor a different direction, but we'll get to that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So again, I try to keep like 300 grams for me on hand because I know when I bake, I'm going to use 200 grams. Okay. That leaves me with 100 grams. That 100 grams that I've got left, it's ready to be fed because I've had it in my refrigerator and now it's warmed up and it's hit its peak. I need to feed it. So now I've got 100 grams of starter. I'm going to add my 100 grams of water, my 100 grams of flour, mix it up, and then I'm going to put that back in the refrigerator so I have 300 grams again. So every single time, I've got enough to bake and enough to feed. And I never have to make, I bake probably once a week. Some of it's going to have to do with how often you bake. You may want less if you're going to bake less, just because that starter, have I gone a month? Yep. I've left it in there a month. But then you've got to feed it a couple times because the flavor profile is going to be a little off. So then if you're only going to bake sporadically, keep less in your refrigerator, but just plan on the front end of feeding it a few times to get what you're going to need to bake. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's see. I guess that's it. Yeah, if you do the discard thing where you take half and throw half and yada, 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 that's a lot of discard. In fact, this cute little kid's book that I found called The Bread Pet, they had a little issue in the book where all of a sudden they had all this sourdough starter because they kept feeding it and dividing it and feeding it. And it's like, what do you do with it all? There are things you can do with sourdough starter. Discard, you can make crackers, you can make pancakes, you can do stuff with it. If I'm going to do that, I'm just going to use the starter that I've got. I just, because then it's like something else I have to think about making and budgeting time for and all of that. But there are definitely things you can do with discard. If you ever find yourself in the situation where you've got discard, just if you Google sourdough discard recipes, you're going to get 1,000 of them.
That's just if you're starting a new starter is when you would have
this? No, you might have, she asked if it would be just if you're starting a new starter. Not necessarily. If you haven't used yours in a long time, you may want to cut it back and then feed up so it's nice and fresh. You're welcome. Let's see.
Does it kill the organisms to put the starter in the freezer?
It's not supposed to. I haven't done it, but if there is a better way, I think, of doing that. And she asked if putting it in the freezer kills the organisms. You know, you can buy frozen pizza dough. You can buy frozen bread dough. So it shouldn't kill the organisms.
If you go away for a while.
Right. A better way to save it would be, I think, and it works pretty well, is if you take your sourdough starter and on a piece of parchment or a piece of wax paper or cling wrap or whatever, spread a really thin layer and let it air dry, and basically you're making little flakes and they can be rehydrated at a later point in time. And if you have to travel with it, that's a secret for traveling with it too, because they don't want you to take this kind of fun stuff on the airplane. Okay, so we're back to this starter that we forgot to feed. This is our first part where we're going to smell this stuff. Now, what does underfed or starving starter smell like? Usually, it'll smell like acetone or fingernail polish remover. It's a very strange thing to come from something you've made with bread and flour or water and flour. But that to me is exactly what it smells like. It may have some other off flavors to it, but this layer of liquid on top is alcohol. They also call it hooch. Hey, we got a pooch. I said hooch, not pooch. I don't think Noah's going to want this.
Yeah. No.
No, like everything, all the people.
Only in that element, right?
Keep going. Keep going. So anyway, if you find yourself in this situation, if you've got more than a quarter inch of liquid on top, pour it off till the... Pour it off until you've got only about a quarter of an inch of it left. Mix it in. And then you're going to do that thing where you're going to do the 1-to-1-to-1 ratio of flour and water and starter. Even this one in the picture that's black, that can be revived. Unless it is truly mold and is fuzzy, then get rid of it. But usually, if it turns, usually when it turns black like that, it's really just oxidation is all it is. Just like when you peel a banana and the banana gets black. It's no different. So I'm going to open this up. Oh, one other thing. This reminds me, because this will probably make a noise when I open it. When you keep your starters, do not screw your lids on too tight. Gas builds up in there, and it can break a glass jar. So keep it loose, just kind of finger tight. And this one's definitely too tight, and it may hit. No, it didn't. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Here, I'll just let you guys pass that around. And Electra, you're going to have to tell me if you can see or not.
All right. Let's see.
Doesn't it smell like fingernail polish remover? So, I have not tried it, but it will make things have an off taste because that's alcohol. It'll make the flavor a little weird. Then the other starter I'll pass around, you'll be able to tell the difference between them.
So you're saying mix in a little bit of the alcohol.
Yeah, mix that in because that's going to keep your liquid level good. But if it's more than a quarter of an inch, it's going to make that, you're going to have to feed it several times in order to balance the flavor back again. So, moving on. All right. We're going to get to the bake part. I may as well pass this one around. This one's got more of a, so this one you can, I better show them here. You can see this one, okay, what I like to do is I like to put a rubber band around, when I've just fed it, I like to put a rubber band on where it hits in there. That way I can see when it's doubled in size and then it's ready to bake with. You always want to bake with it when it's at the top of its rise. This one you can see is just about doubled. Sometimes they'll triple. But you want to make sure it's at least doubled in size. It's good. It's active. This will have more. This one's got some wheat and rye in it. It's just going to have a little bit more of a nutty taste, a little fresher or smell, a little fresher, kind of biscuity.
What do you do with that one that's got the...
This guy?
Yeah, how do you fix that?
That I'm just gonna stir that in there and I'm gonna feed him.
So that's the way you do the
yep
amount, okay.
Exactly.
And then how often are you feeding it though?
Well, this one's not gone too long. I just kind of I left him out on the counter just to make sure that I could kind of get it way past its prime. It's gonna be I don't know. I'll probably just feed this one once. It didn't have that much liquid on it, but if it looked bad and had a lot of liquid, I'd probably feed it 2 to 3 times.
And then when you're feeding it, are you keeping it in the refrigerator, putting it in the refrigerator, or are you keeping it on the counter when you're feeding it?
She asked if, when I'm feeding it, if I'm keeping it on the counter or putting it in the refrigerator. Personally, again, this is what suits my lifestyle is, I feed it, I use what I'm going to use, and that part that I've just fed, freshly fed, I slam that back in the refrigerator. I know they're going to tell you in the books that you shouldn't do that, that you should let it come up and then put it in. But then by the time I get to it, it may have started falling again and gone past. It'll continue to rise in the refrigerator. Thanks. So you can just stick it back in. But again, do what works for you. Figure it out. But if it's on the counter, it's going to need to be fed more often or used more often because it's warmer and more active. The refrigerator kind of makes it go to sleep a little bit.
How do you know what,
do you gauge the gauge as far as when you feed it, when it settles inside, when you feed it again.
Yeah.
Regardless of how long that's been. So it'll be quicker if it's on the counter, not as long as it's in the fridge.
Yeah, what you're going to end up seeing is, so this one, this one started to come down a little bit, I think. Maybe it's just moving it around. But if you see, like once it's hit its peak, and then it starts, those gas bubbles start going out, what'll happen is the solid will drop down, but you'll be able to see a film where it had climbed up the side. So you'll know it's on the decrease, right? Now what'll happen is if you take it, say I had some and it's been on my counter and it started to rise. I actually did that with this today because I wanted to make sure it was active enough to use by the time we got to this portion. It had come up to a good point and I was like, I don't want it to go too far. So I popped it back in the fridge. Well, once you put it in the refrigerator, its activity is going to decrease. So you may see it slide back down, but then when you bring it back out and warm it back up, it's going to come back up again. Because
to use that for that particular bread?
Yeah.
So when it comes to the peak and then starts back down, it's still okay to go, kind of?
Yeah. Yeah, it's okay. It's ideal to use it at its most active state, so at the top of its rise. I've used it on both sides, and it's fine. It's going to consume the food you give it, period. If you have it, if it's a little bit hungry and hasn't quite got up there yet, you're just giving it more food. So it's going to take a little tiny bit longer once you've made your bread to rise the way you want. If it's kind of come back down and you do it, okay, now it's really hungry, so it's going to go a little bit faster. So if the sweet spot's the top of the rise. Again, I don't always stick to that because, you know, maybe I have to go run into work and I wasn't expecting, you know, whatever, life. It's just life. But you can work around that. All right. So any other questions? Anyone online? Okay. We'll move on. So before we start, we're going to talk ingredients. You're going to see if you look at books and look online, if they refer to something as ripe starter, ripe is at the peak of its rise. Think of it just like ripe fruit. Fresh starter would be ones you've freshly fed. It's not going to be very active yet because it hasn't had time to eat all the starch and do its thing. Usually, like I said before, a starter, if you pull it out of your refrigerator, set it on your counter overnight, 6 to 8 hours, it's going to double in a normal. Now, if you keep your house really cold, that's going to take a lot longer. There are some cheats on that. Say it's if it's fresh, like, again, because of the way I do it, I feed it and put it right in the refrigerator. So any rise that's gone on has happened at a cold temperature, so it's coming up slow, but it still needs to come to room temperature and finish its like little deal. So yeah, roughly 6 to 8 hours. If your house is really cold, there's a couple ways to cheat that. Like especially in the winter, it happens. You could put, like, I've got some stainless steel bowls. Sometimes I'll fill it with hot water. And I'll put the bowl of hot water in the microwave and I'll put my jar in the microwave next to it. And then that whole interior will get nice and warm. And I don't turn it on. Don't turn it on. Some people, this is a little dangerous. Some people will put it in the oven with just the oven light on. I have a really good friend whose husband had 100-year-old sourdough starter from Alaska. And he had it in there warming up with the oven light, and his wife went to preheat the oven for dinner. And this is one of the other reasons it's good to have in glass, because his was in plastic. Oh. There was nothing left. Now, if something like that should happen, you could, even if you could just save like a teaspoon of it. You can do the feed it up process and you can probably get it back. But so I stay far away from the oven for doing it, but the microwave, somebody's going to open the microwave to put something in. You don't preheat it. It's usually pretty safe. Sometimes just if you turn the, if your microwave has a surface light under it, if you turn that surface light on and put your stuff in the microwave and close the door, it, that light underneath keeps it warm enough to be a good place. So there's all kinds of, if I have my dish, my old house, if my dishwasher was on, the granite was warm enough right above the dishwasher. So find your little warm spots in your house in the winter and it's all good. It prefers dechlorinated water or filtered water. It's warm to the touch. We already talked about that. Will it work? Yeah, it'll work. It's probably more active if you don't use chlorinated water. That does tend to kill off, you know, things, which is why they put it in the water. Flour. Where I say bread flour is best, but it works with AP, I'm not talking about feeding it here. This part I'm talking about making your bread. So there's bread flour and AP flour, AP being all-purpose. The big difference between them is the protein level of the flours. The higher the protein, the more gluten strands it creates, longer strands. But you can certainly do it with all-purpose flour and you still get a wonderful bread.
Can you do the sourdough starter with non-gluten flours like brown rice flour?
Yes. You can. It's a little trickier, I think, and somebody did email me about that, and I sent her a recipe that looked beautiful. I haven't tried it, but I believe it was brown rice flour that they used to start the start that they used for the starter for that one. So what's going to happen is bread flour with its higher protein content, creating these elastic gluten strands is going to what's going to help keep those carbon dioxide bubbles in there and make a nice, it gives it, and then I put a little all-purpose with mine. I kind of split it. The all-purpose seems to give it a little more strength. So one's real stretchy and the other gives it a little strength. So I do a combination. Again, experiment, see what you like. Sometimes I will, you know, sometimes it'll be, this one was, my starter had wheat and rye in it, but the bread itself, the recipe, I just stuck to white flours. But you can certainly put in whole wheat. You can sub in, don't do much whole wheat and don't do, like, I think you want less than half of the flour in it to be whole wheat. Whole wheat's very moisture sucking, so that's why it's kind of a dry bread sometimes. So you could bump your water up a little bit. Salt, I always use just I like kosher salt. It kind of melts down real nice and fast when it hits, when it gets the liquid. Sea salt's great too. And you can use regular salt. Okay. So the recipe we're working from, and it's in your handouts also, it's called Beginner's Artisan Sourdough. It came from a website called Homemade Food Junkie. And if you end up going to that, and I highly recommend you reference, if you're going to use this recipe, go to her site, check it out. She's got videos so you can see what things should look like. She's got lots of pictures, and it's a blog, so there's a lot of stuff to read through, but there's some great information on there. But it's a very simple recipe. 100 grams of starter, ripe, so it's at the peak. Her recipe that's in there is actually doubled this, so I just split it down. 262 grams of water, 350 grams of flour. I split mine between bread flour and all-purpose, and then 10 grams of salt. And that is all that's in this. So here's what we're going to do. I've got the one starter, the fresh starter that I passed around. I'm going to mix this up so you can see, like if I tell you whisk it, the flour until it's shaggy, what shaggy means. Okay. One of the things a lot of the websites and books are going to tell you is do a float test on your starter to see if it's active enough. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Period. I never do it anymore. I used to when I was getting started. The reason they tell you to do it is because if it's at the top of its rise, it should have the maximum amount of gas in it, so it should float. But you'll usually, I mean, when you put it in your bowl too, sometimes it'll stick to the bottom, but once you start stirring, you can see in that picture it's risen to the top. It'll usually float. If you've seen it double in size, some of that depends on the type of flour you use. A wheat flour is going to be a more dense thing, so it may not float. So take that with a grain of salt, and I just don't do it. If it's doubled, it's probably good to go. So what we're going to do here is, because I like to weigh things, and we're going to talk about if you don't have a scale. But if you do, you're going to zero out your scale. Well, actually, you're going to zero it out once you put your bowl on. I know that there's 100 grams in here because I measured it. Oh, interestingly, when you feed your starter and it's fresh, just freshly fed, what weighs 100 grams when you freshly feed it is going to weigh slightly less when you go to use it. It consumes the starch and leaves you with gas. So it'll weigh a little bit less. It's a negligible amount. So all I'm going to do is I'm just going to put my starter in the bowl. And one thing, if you're not weighing, how do you know what 100 grams of starter is? You might not. You can Google that, but one of the other things you should do is when you're measuring starter by volume instead of weight, stir it down first. So you're going to stir the air bubbles out. The air bubbles aren't anything in the starter that's going to affect the dough that you're going to make. They're there. And when I dump it in, all the air is out of it. It's just a big...
I have a question.
Yeah.
So this starter you took from your 300 grams from the fridge,
mm-hmm.
separated 100 grams out,
yep.
and then you fed it?
I fed, well, in this case, I did. So this is the stuff I'm using. The stuff I was left with, I fed it and put it back in the refrigerator.
This one you don't feed. You just let it rise.
This is the one I'm using, so I'm just going to let that rise.
Okay.
And then... So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to add water. This isn't warm. This is air room temperature water. So we're going to add 262 grams of water. If you were doing it by volume instead of weight, most of your measuring cups now will have milliliters on the other side, and just remember 1 milliliter is the same as 1 gram. And then there are, you can find all these conversions online, but for this purpose, we're going to do 262. And I know that 2 cups is about, I think it's 500 milliliters or right in there. So, all right, I'm at 264 grams of water, slightly off. If you look online, they're going to talk about hydration in doughs. I think this dough, if I remember right, runs about what they would call a 65% hydration dough. The higher the hydration of the dough, you can create these doughs. Like if you've ever seen, there's one called a pain de cristal. And it's like got big open holes in it. It's used a lot of times like for a sopping bread for soups and stuff like that. It wouldn't be ideal for toast because the butter is going to run through the holes and end up all over your hands. But those are higher hydration doughs. The higher hydration creating more steam, on and on and on. But for these purposes, I think this is around 65%, 67%. There's a conversion, you know, if you're looking at a recipe and you want to figure out what the hydration is, and the reason that'd be important is higher hydration, harder to shape. Lower hydration, it's going to be easier to shape. This one kind of sits in a nice spot where it's, you're going to get a nice spread out of it, but you're also going to have a easier time shaping it. So I'm just going to take my Danish whisk and I'm just going to mix this all in. And one other thing, if you were like me and sometimes bake with cold starter, which is not advised, it will not mix in very well. It'll stay clumpy in the water. So this one was nice and warm. The water's warm. So it's just gonna, I don't know if you can see this or not, I'll hold it down low. It basically looks like mud water or clay water. Here, maybe, can you see that?
Let's see. Okay, thanks.
Is that a good spot for the camera? I'm going to guess.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So now we're going to put the flour in. Yes, it does. So I'm going to add my flours. I pre-measured these. I've got all-purpose and bread flour in here, just like I said I do. Like I like to use. So I'm just going to dump that in there. You are not going to put the salt in yet. The salt comes in. We're going to let this rest for an hour before we put salt in there. The reason we do this is it gives the gluten a chance to form. So it's just kind of a resting phase where everything gets active. Salt can inhibit that a little bit, so to give it its best shot, we're going to wait, say, an hour before. You can wait as long as 4 hours. So again, if all of a sudden your husband calls, he's like, I can't get the kids. Can you go get the kids? At this point, anywhere from 1 to 4 hours, it can sit before you add the salt. So you're going to mix this until you get a shaggy dough. And there, it's getting pretty shaggy. So, for you guys, can you see that? Electra?
Yeah. I can see it.
Okay.
Yep.
You could not?
Okay. I can see it.
So there
we can see it. Thank you.
So, this is what's referred to as shaggy. It doesn't really hold its shape. It looks,
Can you just use a KitchenAid mixture? Or is it better to do it by hand?
It's so easy, I wouldn't waste my time dirty
with
it.
Yeah.
And you will not knead this dough at all. There's no kneading involved,
okay.
Which is kind of nice too.
Yeah.
So this guy's just going to sit and cruise now. He's going to sit for an hour. After an hour, I would add the salt, and I would mix the salt in, and that's when you're going to do what your first, what we call a stretch and fold. And
you mix the salt in with that cool tool?
What I usually like to do is I usually like to sprinkle the salt on the top of the flour water mixture, and then get your hands wet, and I like to just kind of aerate it, or just push it down in holes so I don't have like a glop of salt that gets buried in there. It kind of helps to mix it in. And then I'm going to pull this dough up and around and just kind of stretch it a bit to blend it and then let it sit once we put that salt in it. Now this dough is ready for a stretch and fold. It's gone through a few stretch and folds already. This is what you're doing instead of kneading the dough. And it's super easy. And I like to use this to kind of help get it all off the sides a little. I've got a bowl of water back here, so I'm just going to wet my hands.
Make sure we see this.
Oh, you will. So I wet this, I wet my hands. I'm just going to run this. It's hard to do with wet hands. Hold this and do it. But I'm just going to run it around the side.
What is the name of this item that you're wetting?
This is just a bowl scraper. It's a flexible piece of plastic. So that's all. You could use whatever. Thanks. So a stretch and fold. Can you come here up here, Lisa Marie?
Uh-huh.
I'm going to get an assistant here because I need another set of hands. Okay. Hopefully you guys can see this. So a stretch and fold, pretend this is the face of a clock with 12 o'clock facing away from you. All you're going to do is you're going to reach in there. Whoops, I loosened it so much, came up. You're going to pull it up. You're going to fold it over to 6 o'clock. You're going to rotate it a quarter turn. You're going to do that again. So you're going to do that for each quadrant. This guy's pretty well and good. Another way to do it is you're going to feel it texture change. So once it gets a little further along, you really have to do the stretch and fold for probably the first two. But then you can kind of pick it up like this and do what's called a coil fold. You're basically just going to coil it and coil it the opposite direction. And then you've got this nice little ball you can put back in there. So thank you. So that's all you're going to do for that. That's a stretch and fold. You're going to do that every half hour for 2.5 to 3 hours. Ideally, you want probably 6 stretch and folds. With each one, you're going to feel that dough change. It's going to go from really goopy and sticky to, by the last one, you're going to pick it up. And it's going to hardly stick to you at all. It's going to be nice and well-formed and very elastic. So that's that. One of the other things, so we're getting ready now. We did this, so here's an example of a stretch and fold here. Again, all that says is just what I explained, folding it over. Think of it as the face of a clock.
Can you keep it covered in between those things? Can you use a tea towel or do you need something?
Okay, so she asked if when you keep it covered in between, if you can use a tea towel or if you use something else. I tend to like my plastic bowls all have a lid, so I tend to like to keep just the lid on it, but I think I'm just concerned about our, it's so dry up here. In Illinois, I had no problem just doing a tea towel. You don't want to skin the form on it is all. So
you can even put a plate over it.
You could put a plate over it. Totally could put a plate over it. Anything like that. Foil. And this one I just had a piece of parchment sitting on the top of it. So just something to hold the moisture in is all. So we'll put that back on there. Again, these are on the counter. You're not putting it in the refrigerator sitting on the counter. So you're going to do that for a total of 6. By the time you get to that 6th one, you're going to start seeing little bubbles under the surface. That's good. It means it's basically ready to go. This next part is the hardest part, aside from waiting to eat your bread, I guess. Let's see. This one's going to take a little work to make sure you guys can see. So I'm going to have to move this computer around. We're going to shape this dough. This one, actually, I'm going to show it to you. It's shiny. There's little surface bubbles. Can you guys see that online?
Yes. See the surface bubbles? Yeah.
So now it's shiny, certainly not shaggy. It looks kind of silky almost. But yeah, you're going to see little tiny bubbles starting under there. They're nothing big. Oh, no, I forgot some flour. Should have used all that. All right. theoretically, when you do this, this is going to pose a challenge. I'm just putting this on a cutting board right now. No flour on the cutting board, and that part is by design. And then I'm just using my bowl scraper again because I can get almost all of it out with that. Just pile it on there. At this point, I would get my hands full of flour. I would put flour all over the top of the dough. Now, this is where your bench knife comes in. I'm going to move, hold on, let me move a couple things. Let's see, I'm going to move this computer. Electra, if you can tell me when you can see the dough on the cutting board.
Okay, yeah, I can see it. Hey, Kendra, is it a hassle if you take down the, if you take off your, I'm sorry, your screen share so we can get a full view of you? Your, because you have your...
I can do that.
Yeah.
We'll see if I can do that.
It's not a big deal, but...
Here it is. Got it. Stop share.
There we go.
Is that better?
Yes, bigger. Yep.
Okay, now I can see what you're seeing.
Yay!
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this bench knife. This hand would be full of flour, so I'm probably going to stick where I normally wouldn't, but I'm right-handed. So this bench knife, what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be putting it under the edge and pulling it around this way while this side supports it. So it's just, I'm going to try and do it without touching it a little bit, but it would be, this is the motion you want. You can see it's forming a nice little ball.
This is fun.
What?
This is making me laugh. This is fun. And this is not bread for dummies. FYI, like
it is. It's not. Well, it's a lot of work. I didn't say it wasn't a lot of work, but it's so worth it. So you're just gonna go. It's so much easier with flour because. But this is shaping up pretty well. So you want it in a nice little ball like that, and yeah, I'm gonna do this.
Maybe the water will help.
So one of the other things after you've done that, you can take it and go like this too. You're kind of tucking it under with your fingers.
So move this.
Kendra, do they all know you're a ceramicist? That's why you make this look easy.
No, we haven't got into that. But yeah, I do pottery. So this part's a little bit like clay. But yeah, you're just tuck the ends under, and you're creating some surface tension because you're winding it up, so it's becoming a little bit tight on the inside, and you can always go back to your knife if that's easier. But I'm just going around and around like this. Now this shape that it's in, that's kind of nice and ideal, and if it were dusted with flour, it's going to hold its shape really well because you're getting a little bit of a skin on top, which will also help it hold its shape. So at this point, we're going to rest it for 20 minutes. And when you rest it, you're just going to take a little towel at this point, throw it over the top, and you're going to let it rest for 20 minutes. We're going to shape it one more time. This was just called the pre-shape. So that's all we're going to do there. When you do your final shape in 20 minutes, that dough is going to start relaxing out. It's going to maybe look more like this as opposed to up like that. That's why we go back. We're going to do that again, put more flour on the top, do that. Some sites will have you flip it upside down and fold it in quarters over each other to create that tension. I have found that when I do that, it's not my forte, it will sometimes open up on the bottom. So it's, for me, it's done really well to just reshape it the same way, not pulling it off of this. When we go to reshape it, I'm just dusting flour over the top and doing it again till it's nice and tight.
When you do the flour, is it the brown rice flour, or does it not matter?
No, at this point it doesn't matter. Okay. It's just, I use just the regular all-purpose flour.
You said nice and tight. Like what does that feel like when you're working with the dough?
So she asked what it feels like, nice and tight. I would say like a water balloon, if I had to compare it to something. It's got, you know, it still kind of moves, but it doesn't feel like it's going to melt out of its shape. This one, you can tell, still feels like it's, well, you can already see that it's starting to collapse out a little bit, which is normal for its first shaping. And it's going to be extra normal since it has no flour on it. I'm hoping this towel kind of sucks a little moisture off it. But so that's all you're going to do. You're going to repeat that process again. I'm going to move you guys back up here. There we go. And I'm going to screen share this again. Let's see, do we miss anything on here?
You're doing a great job at keeping us included on my...
Oh, good. Thank you. You can't see the slide yet, can you?
No, let me make sure I've got you up. Let's see. You should be able to now.
I think I need to see it. Hold on, I can... Here we go. I may have to... You may lose my voice for a second as I do this, but...
We got it.
All right. Can you hear me?
Perfect.
Can you? Okay, I'm assuming you can hear me. All right, so we've been through all that. So that's, basically it's just... Holding that bench knife at that angle and rotating it around. Okay. Are there any questions up to this point?
Bigger, smaller loaves than me?
It shouldn't make any difference. He asked if bigger or smaller loaves would make a difference in the shaping, and it really shouldn't. But, this recipe and this size dough that we've made tonight is going to make you a loaf about that big. So it's a good size loaf. I've made bigger ones. They expand when you put them in your Dutch oven. They are going to get bigger. So this loaf that I put in, what you saw here, once we put it in the Banneton and then it sits, when you pull it out of there, it's a little bit bigger than this, but not a lot bigger than this. Most of its growth comes when you're baking it. So let's see. Something else I was going to tell you here. Don't get discouraged. There's a learning curve on this part, that little wrist movement and that, but just practice. The first few you make may look a little more flying saucer-like than nice and puffy. And that's okay. That's just more of a shaping issue. That means maybe it didn't get quite tight enough. Maybe it didn't get enough, flour or something to help it hold its shape. It shouldn't be soaked in flour. It shouldn't be all white. It should just have a nice little, the surface should be kind of dry to your touch. You shouldn't stick to it at all anymore. So if you're getting that, work on your shaping. There are so many good YouTube videos, so many good sites out there that have their own little embedded videos in them. Just Google shaping sourdough, and you can watch that technique. It'll come, might be five loaves in. But the bread you make, if it doesn't get super high, God, it's going to taste so good anyway. It doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. Enjoy the bread you're making.
You said the Banneton was not necessary. You don't like seeing it.
Well, I
What do you use? I only use a Banneton now. It's not something that I clean regularly. I mean, eventually it's going to get really wadded up with rice flour, and then I'll scrape that out. But that's all I do. You can clean them with a brush and stuff like that.
If you didn't have one, would a regular bowl work?
If you don't have a Banneton, a regular bowl with a cotton towel dusted with rice flour, or a basket dusted with rice flour. If you use a basket or something with some texture, you're going to get a little bit of that texture on your bread. So it looks pretty neat. You could put a doily in there too, like, you know, something cool to, you know, you can play with that. You're almost done. What's next? So this one, we are going to move. We've shaped this guy. I'm just going to go with this because it's just going to be for my husband and I anyway, and we don't care what it looks like. So the fact that I didn't have flour and then I'm rushing this whole next process, like I said, it should have sat, but it didn't. So I'm going to go around. This is going to be our next shaping. I'm going to go around it again, tighten it up. That little inner spiral that we're creating. And then I'm going to use this to slide it under. And if it were full of flour, it wouldn't stick. Wait. I don't want to. That should help. Oh, that should help a lot. So what you're going to do is just slide this bench knife underneath the dough, and you're going to flip it upside. You're just going to like then be able to lay it down in your Banneton. So you want the bottom side up. You can see in this picture that you can almost see that there was a spiral created, and that that little center point is where it was really tighter. So you're going to dust the inside of this with your brown rice flour. Now we're going to transfer it. I'm just going to go like this and set it in there so it's upside down.
If you don't have a bench knife, what would you recommend for the shaping?
I would use like a pancake flipper or something, because you can hold it. I mean, if you envision this with the thing on it, you can. It's a little awkward to hold, but it's certainly stiff enough, and you can create that.
There's a kit on Amazon for $24. It has all that
stuff. I was going to say, there is a kit on Amazon, and it's got the lime, it's got the Banneton.
If you just put
sourdough kit, it'll pop up.
Okay.
Yep. So we've transferred it to the Banneton. You're basically done till it's time to bake. This goes in the refrigerator now. You want to put it in a plastic bag. So I just do this. This is an old bread bag. The large vegetable bags at the grocery store, if you have extra of those laying around that you're planning to recycle, they work great for this. So I just kind of twist, if it's big enough, I twist it up and set it on there just so it's not getting air. This would go in the refrigerator at this point. Now, what makes it sourdough is, you know, all that activity we talked about with the yeast and the bacteria. It should really, ideally, be in your refrigerator for 6 to 8 hours. It can go way longer, and you could bake it the same day if you really wanted to. Flavors are going to be different. The reason, and I think that's my next slide. Yep. So, adjusting the taste. The reason the flavors are going to be different, most of that is temperature dependent. If you want a more sour bread, we want to slow that fermentation rate way down. So we do, when it's in the refrigerator for 6 to 8 hours, that's called a cold retard. You're retarding the fermentation process. You're slowing it way down. What takes over then is the bacterial action. So that the cilia is going to take over, and that is going to create more acetic acid. Acetic acid, vinegar, basically, is what's going to give it the more sour taste. So commercial breads a lot of times will add things to it to create that sour flavor. This we're going to do naturally by slowing it down in the refrigerator. Another way you can make it more sour is use a little less starter. The reason less starter is going to work, it's also going to slow the fermentation rate down. Less starter is going to take longer to develop all that yeast or that starch and create more yeast. If you have more starter, it's going to be a faster process. So you're going to get less acetic acid buildup than you are in a slow process. They say feeding it after it peaks. That's also, I haven't really paid attention that much to notice, but if you feed it after your sourdough peaks, that's also supposed to create a more sour flavor. Feed your starter less often. Like we talked about before, that starter is going to get really tart and have more, you know, if it has that hooch in it and stuff, that's going to lend itself more toward a, I probably feed mine once a week. I bake once a week, so I feed it once a week. Some of the books will tell you you should feed it every day or every 2 days. That's going to result in a more mild starter, a little less sour. Once a week, I like that sweet spot. If you feed it more whole grains, particularly rye, that will give it a more sour taste. And that goes back to those phytates that are on there. Using a mature starter. So we talked about creating your own starter from gathering wild yeast. That's an immature starter because it's brand new. The flavor is not going to be as deep. A mature starter, like you're getting today, is going to have a little more tang to it. If you like that little bit more yeasty, a little less sour, play with it on that end. If you want to bake that bread the same day, say you've got to this point, you're going to want it in your refrigerator so it gets at least like maybe 3 to 4 hours. You want it cold. And the reason you want it cold is when you slice into it, you don't want it to go. If that's cold all the way through, that's going to be a stiffer dough.
Yeah. Can you identify the tanginess as a starter and know where you're at just by flavor?
You could if you can I?
Yeah. You're going to go, oh yeah, that's really ripe or it's really starting to
for me,
sour
it's,
up.
For me, it's, I don't particularly care for the taste of raw sourdough starters. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is sour. I've tasted it. But for me, it's smell. I mean, you will really, if you pay attention when you're making your dough to what it feels like at the different stages, what it looks like at the different stages, and what it smells like, you really aren't going to have to, you'll get to the point where you just know. You know what it's supposed to feel like, you know what it's supposed to smell like, and you're good. I can tell when my starter isn't quite active enough. It's, you know, it's missing that little bit of sourness to it where it smells like, when you open it up, and it's like fully ripe, it kind of smells like beer. You know, it's got that more yeasty, it's got an active smell to it. When it's more immature, I would liken it more to pancake batter. You know, pancake batter doesn't smell active. I guess that would be the bigger difference. But basically, if you want it a little less yeasty, you can flip the process on this. I've definitely baked it all in one day. And there are also some really good recipes online for bake in a day sourdough bread. It's not going to be so sour. It's going to be just nice, good bread.
Yes? Yeah. You think you use less starter?
Mm-hmm.
On this recipe, it says you use 100 grams of starter.
Yes.
You use like 75 grams?
So what she asked was, this recipe uses 100 grams, and when it says use less starter, what does that mean? Should you use 75 grams? Yeah, you could try that. Again, experiment with it. If you use 75 grams, just realize the process for it to get to where you're going to bake it is going to take longer because it's so. Again, those are things you just start to play with. Take some notes, you know, say this is what I tried this time, and then the next time try something different and see if you like it better, or see if you notice a taste different. You know, maybe initially you might not notice a big taste difference, but I think the reason they call this a beginner sourdough is because it uses a lot of starter compared to other breads. So it's got a jump start, essentially. So let's see.
Have you ever tried buckwheat flour?
I've eaten buckwheat, but I have not tried buckwheat flour.
So
no.
Does it rise here, or does it rise till it gets to the cast iron pot?
It's still going through a rise. He asked if it doesn't rise till it gets to the cast iron pot. When you put it in the refrigerator overnight, it'll continue to rise some. And if your refrigerator is a little warmer than normal, it may rise more than you want. So one of the things you kind of, you'll learn as you go, is you're probably more in danger of overproofing it than you are underproofing it. So overproofing it is going to mean that, especially coming into summer, your house is warmer. It's gonna go faster. If your refrigerator happens to be a little warmer than ideal, or I like to tuck mine in the back corner. Your refrigerator, just like your oven, has warmer and cooler spots. Find the cool spot and shove that baby back in there if you can. Right under the light in your refrigerator. I have definitely noticed a difference if my refrigerator is full and I end up like stacking it on top of the orange juice and it's up by the light, I definitely notice a difference. It's continued to rise more rapidly in the refrigerator than the other one that I've got kind of tucked in the back. Underproofing it is usually will happen in the wintertime if it's going to happen, just because our houses are colder. So you're not getting, you'll be able to feel that though, in that your dough is going to feel stiffer when you're working with it, because it's not going to be quite so elastic yet. That won't have developed as much. So when we bake this, when we bake this guy, I preheat to 500 with the Dutch oven in the oven. Hot Dutch oven, cold bread. There's another method called cold start. I tried it once. I didn't have a lot of success. I tend to go back to what I know just because I want my bread when I want my bread. A cold start would be putting the Dutch oven and putting your bread in a cold Dutch oven, in a cold oven, and coming up. So you're avoiding the preheat process. I didn't have as much luck with it. I didn't get as nice of, they call it oven spring. When that dough goes from this to this, that's called oven spring. I didn't get as nice an oven spring when I do that. One of the things is when this cold dough gets in that baker, that creates that steam process, it's that moisture is going to prevent the top from hardening up. It's going to keep it soft, right? So it can continue to expand. This is one of the reasons why the oven rise or the spring is a little bit better when you're doing it in a covered situation rather than just putting the dough in the oven. When you just put the dough in a hot oven, it bakes that top of the dough and it gets a little firm, and then it's harder for it to expand. So the moisture in there keeps that skin layer soft so it can continue to expand. So we're going to start 500 oven, Dutch oven in it. I do about half an hour heat up. I think my oven lets me know it's hit the temperature at about 15 minutes. So somewhere in there. I let it go a little longer just to make sure my cast iron thing is fully heated up. Do you have to play with it? You know, if you don't want to preheat that long, try it and see. But this is the method that this website uses, and this is the method that I generally stick to. But again, I'm putting two in at the same time. So for me, I'm getting two out at the same time rather than doing one and one. I've kind of consolidated my baking. I could get three in there if I had another baker. So now we're going to pull this hot guy out. We're going to take, say this one was ready. I'm going to take it out of here. Now it's cold. I've just pulled it out of the refrigerator. I'm going to pull this out. I'm going to put my parchment on top just so it touches. And then now that thing's hot, so have your oven mitts ready. Then I'm just going to invert it. I'm going to flip it over so this bread is sitting on here. It's now out of the banneton. Usually I'll go around and I'll loosen the edges before I flip it just a little bit, because if it's going to stick anywhere in here, it's going to be at the top where you might not have quite as much of the flour or the brown rice flour, but usually it's okay. So now I've flipped it onto the parchment, and I am going to use my lam. And I'm going to make a cut in the surface of it, holding it at about a 30-degree angle. That angle coming in this way is what, if you've ever seen an ear on a bread where that little top rises up, that's what creates that. If you go straight in, it'll just open it. You know, you're just going to have a nice little line down it, and that's fine too.
Use a really sharp paring knife?
I would... Yeah, probably, as long as it's super sharp. You can use, she asked about a sharp paring knife. So that can work as long as it's really sharp. You can also, I've used, before I had one of these, I've used an X-Acto knife. I've tried, I tried anything in my kitchen
that's
I had. It actually will slide better if you just get a drop of water and put it on the edge, or even a little olive oil. It'll slide through rather than stick. But if the blade's super sharp, you shouldn't need to put anything on the blade. It should cut through really nicely.
How deep is the cut?
Maybe 1/4 inch. But at that angle rather than straight down. But either way, you're not going to hurt your bread. It's an aesthetic thing, and it's going to prevent your bread by putting that cut in it as it expands. If you didn't have that cut, it would just crack open. So that's why we put that there. So you're going to cut it. You're going to make that little slice, and then I just pick my bread up. My bread's sitting on here. I just pick this up by the corners and then set it in my Dutch oven. Cover it, put it back in the oven. I'm going to cook it for 15 minutes with the lid on. After 15 minutes, I'm dropping the temperature to 450, leaving the lid on, and it's just about a half an hour, depending on, you know, how accurate your oven is. If you go on her website, her cooking time's a little shorter. This is the only change I've found that I have to make to this recipe at high altitude. It's just going to require a little bit longer cooking time. Everything else stays the same. And I have factored for that in this 30 minutes, because I think hers was like 20 minutes.
Kendra, can this be made in a bread maker instead of an oven?
I've never tried. I'm sure somebody could try that. I don't know. I don't see why not. But most bread makers have different type of recipes that kind of accommodate for the fact that it's a bread maker. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, what was your question? Yeah. So she asked about the parchment paper. So let's see. I need some fake bread. This is my bread. It's now sitting like this. So, well, before I get it in there, it's sitting like this. So now I'm just gonna, I'm taking the lid off of this because it's hot. And then I am gonna pick this up like this. And I'm just set it in there.
And the parchment paper doesn't burn?
Parchment paper doesn't burn. No, in fact, I have found that I can use my parchment paper for two bakes. It gets really brittle after that, and it gets hard to pick up. And on the second one, I do kind of support it a little more as I'm moving over here because I don't really trust it. But, yeah, I'll get two bakes out of it.
If we're at a much higher altitude, which part of the bake should we increase the time on?
I would probably, if you're at a higher altitude than we are here, I would probably, how high are you?
9,000 feet.
You're good. Just leave it. If you're at like 9,000 feet, you're probably good. If you're going to Breckenridge and you're maybe adding 1,000 to 1,500 feet on top of that, I might add a little bit to the 30-minute bake time. I'd leave the 15.
Where it's
at 450. Yeah, 450 with the lid on. I'd maybe increase that a little bit. And I have baked in Breckenridge, and I think that's basically what I did. Then once we're going to take the lid off, we're going to leave it at 450 and cook it 5 to 10 minutes. I'm finding here I'm at 8,500 feet. I'm finding it's probably closer to 5 to 7 minutes that I leave the lid off. And all that's really happening in this time is the surface is caramelizing nicely, and you're getting a little of that water out of the bread, so it's not gummy. We've held all that moisture in there by having the lid on. So now it's time to let some of that go. It's done its job. We want a little of that off of there, so it's not going to be gummy. And that's all that last little bit of time does. And then if you can do it, cool it on the wire rack for 30 minutes before you cut it. It's super hard because you want to get, it smells so good. But by doing that, more of that moisture is leaving it. If you try and cut it when it's hot, it will kind of gum together a little bit. Now, if you let it sit, it'll kind of go back. But it's ideal if you can let it cool a little bit. And if you can't, I suggest just kind of cutting a little edge and then ripping it, because then you're not going to squish it. And that's it. So it sounds like so much work. Okay, a couple other slides here, but it sounds like so much work. It's really just getting yourself in a rhythm and knowing that the labor-intensive part isn't really labor-intensive. It's just checking in every half an hour. And then most of what the bread does is just sit and chill. I mean, sits and chill for a half an hour between your stretch and folds. It sits and chills for an hour before you put, I mean, there's a lot of it just resting around. Can you mess with the schedule? Totally. I have done it where I might have only stretched and folded twice because I was running my kids around or whatever. And I was like, oh, let me start the bread. I can't finish it. It's fine.
Have you ever, put herbs in there, like rosemary and stuff?
Yes, I have, and that, I think I've got that on, the next slide.
Oh.
But one thing, you're going to make a few ugly breads. You are. What do you do with them? Oh, make bread pudding. It's phenomenal. It doesn't have to be pretty. You're going to dice it up. Croutons, diced up. Throw a little olive oil in there, some seasonings. Pop them in the oven for, at, 325, 350, and just keep an eye on them. They're so good. My kids used to eat them just as snacks right out of the thing. Breadcrumbs, panzanella, that kind of croutoni, Italian croutoni salad stuffing. It's all good. My sample timeline, just because I'm sure that was totally overwhelming. If I have my starter as cold in the refrigerator and I know it's fairly fresh, because I've just baked a couple days ago. It's not in here?
Will you email it out?
I can, for sure. Did I not put it on there? Maybe I didn't. I might have ran out of... Bake. Nope. Nope, you're right. It's not on the handout, but I will email that to you. So I'll just pull my starter out of the refrigerator, set it on the counter before I go to bed. This is assuming I want to mix it the next day, and I know I want to eat it the day after that. Again, I'm sorry? Leave the lid on just so nothing gets in it, but leave it on loose. So I just take my starter out the night before. I go through this process with all my mixing and all that stuff we just went through. I shape it then, put it in the fridge, and then leave it sit. Even if I've done that, like, and it's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I just put the bread in there, it's fine. If I don't get to that bread till the next day or even the day after, it's still going to be okay. You can probably push it like a day and a half in the fridge before you bake it, maybe even longer, depending on how cold your refrigerator is. And that's just going to make it more sour again.
So is that 10 a.m. step? That's the first step that you
started. That's the very first step when we took the starter and mixed it with the water.
That's not feeding the starter, which you...
No, because I've...
Because that really the night before. Okay.
Well, because I just have my starter in the refrigerator. So I just pull out what I'm going to need and I set it on the counter so that in the morning it's ready to play with. Throw that starter in the morning, go through the process, throw it, slam it in the refrigerator, and then tomorrow night... You know, just plan about 2 hours because you know it's roughly an hour to bake, plus your preheat and then a little cool. So that's roughly 2 hours before you want to eat it. But again, if I take my start, I could have taken the starter out in the morning and I could have hurried it up to the point if, you know, I like make a like nice warm water bath and sit it in there. Put it in a sunny window. If you have seed starting mats, you can put it or a little greenhouse thing. You can make that cold starter be ready for you by lunchtime so that you can just remember you need at least a day that you're planning before you're going to eat that bread unless you're cool with cooking it the day of, baking it the day of. Back to Lisa Marie's question. What can you add? My favorites, roasted garlic. Don't use raw garlic. It inhibits the rice. But roasted garlic, awesome. Rosemary. We actually like to do fresh rosemary and Kalamata olives together in a bread. And usually what I'll do with the rosemary is just put a little olive oil in a skillet and give it a quick warm just to get those oils released. Maybe you could even chop it or muddle it a little bit. Awesome with the olives in the bread if you're an olive person. Parmesan, Asiago cheese, that kind of stuff. Awesome in or on your bread. And I like a jalapeno cheddar bread also. And if you want something like Asiago on top, I would put some of that cheese maybe in the banneton before you put your bread in there. That's going to get it to sink in there a little more rather than set on top. But you can mix it in as well. And I will try to remember to send you the proportions. There's a couple things you need to keep in mind when you're mixing things in. Just that, like, cheese is heavy. That's going to inhibit the rise. So there's a certain point where you want to put it in. Like, after the third stretch and fold, you can kind of start stretching and folding it in with it. That gives it time to get going before you throw that in there. The olives and stuff, that doesn't matter quite as much when you put it in. But by the third stretch and fold, the dough's not quite as sticky, so it's probably easier to handle if you're putting it in, you know, about halfway through that process. But there are certain, for this size bread, they'll say 20, if it's cheese, I think it's no more than 25% of the bread weight. So I've got a little chart that I use for these ingredients, and you can probably find that online somewhere. I think that's initially where I found it. But things are great mixed in there. You can also change the color of your bread. That purple bread was done with purple pea flowers. I don't know if you know what they are, but they're used in as a tea. And all that I did for that is you steep it. You steep the pea flowers in there. And I'm trying to remember. This one, I don't think you have to add vinegar. I think it just has that crazy intense color. Beets you can use to color bread, turmeric. Beets you would need to put vinegar. It doesn't hold the color. They fade out. But these are all other things. These things were all things I've made with sourdough pretzels, bagels. I make bagels every other week. You can make baguettes, sourdough pancakes. Pizza crust is another one of our favorites. Sourdough chocolate chip cookies. Use a little brown butter in there. That's good. And then rye bread or other, you can kind of splinter off other directions with it. So yeah, once you kind of get the feel of it, or even before you get the feel of it, try other things. The bagels, I would have to say, are honestly probably easier than the bread. They're like a one-day shot, and then most of their deal is being refrigerated. You don't have to do any stretch and folds, but you do need a pretty substantial mixer or like a upright KitchenAid or a lot of kneading. So that's about it. Just a couple other things. Just when you're making it, just keep bread's origins in mind, that it's just, it doesn't have to be complex. There's a lot of steps, but you don't need to do a lot of the things that are in the book. You can really kind of mess with the schedules and mess with the temperatures and do what works in your lifestyle. Don't let it control you and just have fun with it. I told you guys not to put the starter in your drain, right? Okay. So if you have discard, don't do that. Dry it out or put it in your garbage can or something if you absolutely had to discard something. Chickens love it, by the way. If anybody has chickens, they love starter. A lot of my cat. maybe not the best thing for cats. I don't know. And then what else? I guess that's it. Are there any more questions? No? You're full of. It's a lot of information. So I put my contact information. It's also on the top of the handouts. And for you guys that are online, we'll have the handouts here in the library. I work Monday from 10 to 2. And usually I work Fridays. I won't be here next Friday. Not tomorrow I'll be here, but the following Friday I won't be here. But if you want to pick up starter, some of you have already made arrangements to pick up starter, but you can also get the handouts. And I will also send you an invite so that if you want to look at the slideshow again, if you want to go back and refer to things, because there's pictures on that, you guys will have, I'll include that so you have it too. And if at any point along the way, you get in a bind, you got a question, whatever, my email address is on there. Feel free to shoot me an email or find me on Facebook. I'm Kendra Coltrout. Find me on Facebook. Shoot me a message. I'll walk you through whatever. Or, if you just need to say, can you smell this? Whatever. Happy to help you out.
Great program.
You're welcome.
Kendra.
And then I
thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Nederland Community Library recording. To find more programs, visit nedlib.org.